Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Time now for our play-by-play call of the day. The Nashville Predators, 18 years of existence. First time to the Stanley Cup Final, courtesy of Colton Sissons.
12 seconds remaining in the Anaheim power play. This game tied at 3. On the wall, take it away, Yarncroke. Yarncroke out to center. Drops for Sissons. Power play about over for the Ducks. Here now is Yarncroke. Across for Sissons.
He scores!
Score!
Oh, my goodness.
The score! And the Predators take a 4-3 lead as they were killing off the remainder of a penalty.
They were on their heels most of the game. I mean, they were on their heels most of the game, and suddenly they broke out after a penalty, about 4 or 5 seconds after the penalty. He scored second hat trick in the history of playoff hockey for the Nashville Predators, and Nashville will face either the Penguins or Ottawa in Game 1 on Monday. Ottawa and the Pens play tonight. Very pleased to join somebody that's in the category of a true pro's pro and the voice, the outstanding voice of the Indianapolis 500. You'll hear him Sunday on ABC, Alan Beswick. Alan, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you with us.
Hey, Steve, good to be here. How about Pete Weber? Had a little to get excited about there, huh?
Yeah, a little bit, huh? And plenty to get excited about, huh? The Preds are going to go.
It's a lot of fun.
Oh, there are people down there telling me, and you might know this better than I would, Alan, that in some ways are gaining more popularity than the Titans are because of what they've done.
Well, you know what? It's fun for a community. Anybody that tells you that sports can't bring a community together is just wrong, in my opinion.
I agree.
And a winning sports team, I don't care the community, you know, you can call them bandwagon fans if you want to, however you want to describe it, but, you know, if the Pirates go on a run and they reach the World Series, you'll have people in Pittsburgh talking to other people in Pittsburgh that never would talk to each other anyway about the Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what sports does, and that's what's going on in Nashville now. You know, yeah, Titans may not have had the greatest of success for the last while, I'll just put it.
Yeah.
But you got people in Nashville that may not know anything about hockey and may not be able to know three players on the team rallying because something exciting is happening in their community, and that's just a great thing.
Yeah, and that's what I call the casual fan effect. If you can get the casual fan engaged, that's where you get your numbers, that's where you get your TV ratings.
Yeah, and did you see the scene in Nashville last night?
Oh, my goodness.
You know, after the game. And it was just people having a good time together. And how, you know, I mean, unless I missed something, I didn't see that there was any violence at all related to it. And how great is that? You know, just people having a good time together, brought together by a sports team.
And you're about to witness that with about a 250,000, maybe even more, coming up on Sunday in Indianapolis. I mean, this is one big party. And what has allowed, in your opinion, you know, because racing's had some ups and downs. NASCAR, the ratings have fallen back a bit. Why is it this race continues to be a signature?
Well, I think for a couple of things. First of all, one is history. There is no question that the Indianapolis 500 is the greatest motor race in history. It's known around the world. It's known for being a place where great drivers come test themselves and their machines on what is perhaps the most difficult race course imaginable. The other part of it, I think, is that the world, I shouldn't say the world, let me back up, the community here really embraces the event as their own. Any place you go, you know, these people don't necessarily have to be race fans to know that the Indy 500 is theirs. It's a community-wide thing. From the second you step off the plane in the airport to any hotel, any restaurant you go to, I was at a sandwich place this afternoon, and And I purposefully went kind of off the beaten path, away from the speedway a little bit, just to sit there and read a few things and have a quiet time. And I had like four or five people walk up to me in this little sandwich shop, say to me, "Hey, Sunday's race is going to be great, isn't it?" You know? So it's something that the community really embraces.
Yeah.
And then I think that you expand it out from there. The facility itself is so unique. I mean, think about it. When they had the U.S. Open at Oakmont last year, what was a full house on Sunday? Was that, what, 30,000, 38,000?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep, I was
it's going to be 300,000 people in the same place on Sunday. Absolutely amazing.
You know what's interesting about that? I'll draw a golf analogy as well, because Scott Goodyear, Eddie Cheever, and you talked about this during qualifying. The U.S. Open moves around in golf. The Masters is always played at Augusta National. The racetrack is the constant that the three of you brought up about the racetrack always being the constant in the event.
Yeah, the cars have changed, the technology has changed, the drivers change, and so on. But that racetrack layout has not changed since 1909. The safety apparatus and so on, and thank goodness for it, has evolved. But the layout of that racetrack, it was fit to be the biggest proving ground for an automobile they could fit on the parcel of land that they had. They wanted the longest straightaways they could get. That's how the racetrack came to be shaped the way it is. And it hasn't changed since 1909. And things that have applied over the years to success or failure there still apply to success or failure there. And it is kind of like Augusta National in a way, right? The equipment's gotten better. The players have maybe gotten fitter. But Amen Corner is still Amen Corner.
Yep.
And you roll the ball in the water in Rays Creek, and it's still as big a problem as it was, 40 years ago.
That's right. Scott Dixon rolled around there at better than 232, which is the fastest anyone's qualified since Ari Langdyke did back in 1996. So it's been 21 years. As you watch, now obviously you got to preview it on Saturday, but as you watched it unfold on Sunday, what did you think of driver and machine together?
I thought that you had one of the greatest drivers of his generation, if not the greatest driver of his generation, who, because he's kind of a soft-spoken and quiet guy and doesn't necessarily seek the limelight, doesn't get credit for it, but he was doing his thing under extraordinarily difficult circumstances and getting more out of his machine than perhaps anybody. And it was breathtaking to see. You know, we got a good dose on Saturday of what happens when things go wrong in Indianapolis.
Right, exactly.
We got a real good dose of it. Now imagine strapping yourself back into the machine, the engineer telling you he's taken some of the trim out of it, don't worry, it'll stick. And you're going to go off into the corner and say, okay, going to hold my breath, but I'm going to keep my foot to the floor. I know what might happen if it doesn't stick, but I'm going to make it stick.
It was wow. What's interesting is when Dr. Jerry Punch talked with him, now this is on Saturday, this was not after Sunday, he was talking to him on Saturday, and he made the comment, and you made the observation, of how relaxed and how he's embracing all of it around him. He seems to be enjoying the experience more. Is that his normal demeanor, Alan, or is this something maybe just a little bit different in him?
Now, Scott is one of the coolest customers you'll find.
Yeah.
I mean, he just genuinely is a nice guy. Yet he's also one of the most smart, calculating, skilled racers of modern-day competition. You can put him in anything, and he'll make it better. And he'll find a way to get a little more out of it than someone. When I first got sent over to do the IndyCar races from NASCAR a few years ago, I went to a test session, and the Ganassi team was wonderful enough to me, and their team manager, Mike Hull, to let me stand on their timing stand with him and put one of their closed-circuit headsets on me. And while they were testing, I watched the data come in from the race car. You notice things. I've been around enough to know. Okay, what's he doing there? Well, he's trying to see if he can save a little fuel in that part of the course while not losing any speed. So he's trying things with where he shifts gears and what he did, you know, and you're just like, none of us from the outside would ever know that.
No, heart rate's at 45 in a guy like that.
Yeah, he's that smart and he's that good, and he just is a tremendous champion that is almost unknown to the American public because he doesn't seek the spotlight.
Fernando Alonso, two-time Formula One champ, obviously takes the trip around, and the three of you discussed, hey, look, these are 10 really important miles for him. Others have tried, you know, Tony Stewart raced there several times many, many years ago. What's your impression of him and how he, now it's going to be in traffic, but how he handled his 10 miles, his four laps?
Alonso has done everything right. He has absorbed, well, first of all, he has the great benefit of coming to Indianapolis with the team that's won the race two of the last 3 years.
That's right.
He's got some tremendous teammates. I mean, Marco Andretti is a wealth of experience. Ryan Hunter-Reay won it a few years ago, a wealth of experience. Takuma Sato, while new to the team, knows what he's doing. Brian Herta is the strategist that got Alexander Rossi to the win last year in his first try. So he joins this team that's got this enormous book to start with. Marco, I think, said it best. He said, our cars roll off the truck to start practice at Indianapolis in a good place. And that was to Alonso's benefit. He's very smart. He is a top-level champion race driver, used to studying data, used to talking to engineers, used to understanding what it means. They actually had Rob Edwards, the chief operating officer at Andretti, kind of their chief technical guy for all of the teams. Rob told Scott and I when we talked to him on Saturday, he said, Fernando was in the simulator. Honda has a simulator here in Indianapolis. He said Fernando was in the simulator every morning, then coming to the racetrack every afternoon to practice, and we finally had to ask him to stop because our engineers couldn't keep up with the pace that he was setting of all the preparations, you know, the sim sessions so he's done that much. He's put the work in. He'll do okay, but I'll say this to you, Steve. This has been my story all week. Remember Kurt Busch?
Yep.
Came to the 500.
Yep.
And I said the best thing that ever happened to Kurt Busch was he had a crash.
Right.
And he learned a mistake from it. And from that mistake, allowed himself to step back, start the race slowly. Remember at the beginning of his 500, he fell back to like 30th, and all of a sudden he comes up, and as the day goes on, he moves up, and he moves up, and he moves up, and he finishes 6th.
Right.
And I said all along that if Alonso doesn't crash this month, then I worry for his race because he still hasn't made the big mistake. Now, he might prove me wrong.
Right.
He's only got an hour of practice left and he hasn't crashed. But he's going to get into some situations, particularly late in the race in the 500, he has never experienced before, and that's going to really be interesting to see.
Yeah, because if you do make a mistake and there's a problem that happens, the lesson that you learn from that allows you to go around that track in a different way. That's why the guys like Rick Mears, for example, Rick Mears was brilliant at negotiating 500 miles, knowing it was important to be there at the end.
The last 50 miles, Roger Penske said this the other day. He said the last 50 miles of this race are very different than anything else all day.
Yeah.
And think about it. Alonso hasn't seen those last 50 miles yet. He's got to get to them first. And if he gets to them and he's got a car that's in decent shape and he's going to get racy and he's going to get anxious, he doesn't know if he'll ever race Indianapolis again. He's going to want to take a shot at it. And all those other guys around him are going to want to take a shot at it, too. And they're going to cut him less slack than they might have cut him earlier in the race. It's going to really be fascinating to see how he does.
One final question, Alan. I'll let you go. Thanks a lot for the time. We all appreciate it very much. How are you going to spend the next couple of days? I mean, is there a certain point where you get to a limit and you say, oh, look, I've got this, let's just go? Or are you always searching for that extra nugget?
Well, I think that the latter applies. You're always searching.
Yeah.
But then there comes a point. So Thursday is media day, and you know, today I just left the racetrack, walking around the garages some. You'll talk to all the drivers probably for a last time on Thursday. And Friday you'll see the practice and get some final thoughts from them as you can after the practice. And Saturday's kind of a quiet day. And Saturday I like to sit down and go through a few things in the morning. We do a technical check and a rehearsal and so on, and make sure all the little gadgets that we have planned are working like they're supposed to. And then my producer and I, my producer Jim Guerrero, who's a dear friend, we disappear and we go for dinner, just the two of us.
Good.
And we talk about how we want the telecast to be executed the next day, just the two of us on Saturday evening. And it's really relaxing, and it's really head-clearing, and it's a lot of fun. And I can't wait for the race to start, because I can't wait to see how it's going to turn out.
We all feel that way, and we're fortunate that you'll be at the wheel taking us through it on Sunday. And whomever you work for next will be extremely, extremely fortunate. You're a pro's pro. Alan, thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate the kind words, and any time. It's been fun.
Thanks, Alan. The outstanding Alan Beswick. You will hear him Sunday on ABC for the Indianapolis 500, the 101st running. Tony Knapp next half hour as we continue with more. Brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Sunbury Motors Kia is doing it again, putting the beach within your reach with the Summer's on Us sales event.
I wanna see you in a Kia. Sunbury Motors Kia.
It's back again this May. Buy a new in-stock 2017 Optima Forte or Soul and pay nothing for the summer. That's right, nada, zilch, nothing. In fact, your first payment won't be due until October. And 2017 Sorento start at just $24,973.
Stop the ad for an important announcement from SMC. Kia has just announced $500 in extra cash on 2016 and 2017 Fortes, Optimas, Sorentos, and Souls. But this extra cash is only available until the end of the month.
You'll also get 0% financing for up to 66 months. And with Kia's 10-year 100,000-mile limited powertrain warranty, we're talking a worry-free ride to your vacation destination and no payments to make. It's the Summer's on Us sales event at Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip in Hummel's Wharf.
Tax extra. 0% APR financing. We'll call customers through KMF. Restrictions apply. Warranty is a limited powertrain warranty. For details, see retailer or go to kia.com.
Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. Our thanks to Alan Beswick, the voice of the Indianapolis 500. The Great American Race is coming up on Sunday. The Indy 500 from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It'll be on ABC. It'll be joined by Scott Goodyear and Eddie Cheever. Tony Knapp, next half hour, talking about the business of sports. Oh, we might get into maybe some L.A. stadium issues. Unbelievable. $2.6 billion. You can't tell them to get going now?
Dig, dig, dig. How much does it cost?
It's $2.6 billion. I mean, you can't look at them and say, look, let's get moving here? I mean, it's not as if Stan Kroenke and Ann Walton don't have spare cash.
I mean, they can hire people to have people to get a move on there, you'd think. I mean, it's like, hello, we're hosting a Super Bowl in...
Ann Walton is the heiress to the Walmart, okay, fortune.
Yeah.
Right? And she's the poorest person in the family. I mean, come on. You can't peel some paper?
Yeah, he's not doing pretty well just with the one-year delay now on the stadium. And Arsenal now, for the first time in over 20 years, they're not in the top four in the Premier League. They're out of Champions League. So
they do not. They are not enamored with him.
They're not taking it well over there.
No, they are not. No. They are not enamored with him.
I guess there's supposed to be a meeting this week with the Arsenal board as to whether Arsene Wenger will stay.
Well, I know. I'm excited either way.
I am. Chelsea came back to win the whole thing. I'm ecstatic.
Now, that's your team, right?
That's my team.
Chelsea's your team.
Yep, they've now won two out of the last 3 years, and John Terry with a wonderful send-off, part of the team since he was yay-high for 22 years, and they bring in Antonio Conte. So now it's just going to be interesting to see if they can keep Diego Costa, their star striker. There's been rumors flying that he may go to China. There's now a big Super League over in China that they're they want to build over there, and there's owners over there that are throwing down serious cheddar to get named players over there to add cachet to their brand.
I can imagine that. I can imagine that, that they would do that. Did you see in the Olympics, the Rio Olympics, I touched on this in the first half hour, but the medals that they gave out are falling apart.
Sometimes you see the athletes, even during the ceremony, when they're up on the podium, they will bite into the medals.
Right. Well, it turned out that when they did, they left impressions. That's not good. You finally accomplish your lifelong dream. You win an Olympic medal. You get to display it, and it's peeling and falling apart. I mean,
you're letting friends and other family members, you know.
This is what happens when you put it out to the lowest bidder.
You would think with each Olympiad, they would just stay with the same company to produce the same type, high quality of medals and not skimp.
A good chunk of the 2,000 plus medals from Rio, which were made with recyclable material, have chipped away and shown signs of deterioration. We're seeing problems with the covering on between 6 or 7%. It's a lot bigger than that, Aaron. They said that this stuff is completely normal. Right, this is what happens when you send it over to communications. No, it's completely normal. Don't look over here. Okay, look at the hand. Sean, look at the hand.
Right.
Nothing wrong here. Fire? No, look at the hand. Okay.
Quality control.
The most common issue is that they were dropped or mishandled and the varnish has come off. And they've rusted or gone bad in the spot where they were damaged. Or either that or you gave them junk.
Varnish. For a second, I thought you were talking about restaining your deck.
That's next. The process of producing medals with recyclable material is nothing new, and the medals for the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo reportedly be even more environmentally friendly. They'll be made out of paper mache.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, K Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. And let's bring in the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management, Tony Knopp. Tony, welcome back to the show. It is always great to hear you on the other end.
Best time of the month for me. I love it. How are you guys?
It's great to hear you, my friend. All right, let's start. Let's see. I was in Los Angeles, obviously, for the Rose Bowl. So somebody said, let's take a little trip over to Hollywood Park. I looked around and I said, they're actually building something here? I mean, what does this do in the market that the Chargers are going to have to continue to play for an extra year where they are in Carson, and then obviously in the Coliseum for the Rams?
There's a lot of fallout here. Fallout part one is, for those who haven't flown into Los Angeles, you fly right over it. So this is going to be LA's embarrassment for the next 3 years. I mean, you fly right over Hollywood Park. You get a firsthand view of how far behind they are.
Yep.
For the other two teams, that's a real problem. The LA Chargers now are going to have to play in front of a much smaller venue for a number of years. I mean, they're basically going to be transient for 3 years. And that's a career for a lot of NFL players. Meanwhile, the fan base in LA is a little accepting of the Coliseum for now, but this is going to roll up against the Coliseum being remodeled as well.
Right.
And so there's going to be construction going on both places. And there was rumors today that the Super Bowl has now been moved from LA to Tampa for that year.
Wow.
And LA will have the following year.
If I recall, Tony, the rule, number one, it has to be in a market that has an NFL team. But number two, you have to have really like a test year under your belt.
Right.
To make sure you have. That's why Minnesota's able to get it next year. I mean, that's the way I understand the rule, correct?
You have to have 2 years of test years under your belt, I think.
Okay.
And it comes down to the number of events that they have. So LA's argument has been, we're getting 2 years of test because we have two teams. So there was actually two examples. It was Minnesota and another one that escapes me now, where they were saying that each one of those venues had 20 games by the time they opened for the Super Bowl, and that Los Angeles would have 20 games if they got to keep the Super Bowl on that date. From what I'm told, that's not going to happen.
Wow. Are you surprised with Stan Kroenke's wealth And I also add in the wealth of his wife. I mean, Ann Walton is worth $5.5
billion. Billion with a B,
With a B. And he's worth about 7.4, 7.5, somewhere in that neighborhood. That they can't push this faster just based on the fact that we can throw more money at it?
There's got to be. I mean, what's that old joke? Nine men can't get a woman pregnant in a month. But I think that's what's happening here. I think it's just Los Angeles politics in general. It took them a while to get started. And, you know, for those of us that fly into LAX, you know, every couple of weeks, it became abundantly clear in the wintertime that this had come to a grinding halt. And that had been the case for a number of different public projects that had happened in the LA area. I mean, for people in your neck of the woods, you would laugh at the rain totals we had and using those as an excuse for not being able to continue with construction. I mean, we had what would be considered a very, very mild year as far as rain goes for Pennsylvania. But, I don't think Kroenke had the ability to move this forward at all. And I think the one that's the most affected is Thanos. I think Kroenke is affected, but, you know, the Coliseum still has some suites and still has 90,000 tickets. The L.A. Chargers, where Alex Spanos' team is going to be playing, they only have 30,000 seats. It's a very small soccer stadium. And I just can't imagine, you know, I think it's going to be a neat sideshow for a year or two, but by year three, I think people are going to grow very tired of it.
Well, it's not good that Balboa Stadium, it actually was bigger than this place.
I mean, it's much smaller. I mean, even when you get there, it's small. You know, it looks small, and it is as small as it looks.
Yeah, Penn State. Penn State.
How are you going to sign free agents to come be? Yeah, you're right. That's right. You guys were there for the Rose Bowl.
Yeah.
How are you going to sign a free agent to come play in a transient stadium that only fits 30,000 people? Right. This is going to affect their ability to compete for the next few years. The same with the Rams. I mean, the facilities at USC are very nice, but the facilities at the Coliseum are not that nice right now.
That's right.
Not compared to most of the NFL teams that are out there. And if you're a free agent looking at Los Angeles versus Tampa versus Miami, you know, you've got a new stadium in Tampa, you've got a renovated stadium in Miami, it's going to be a tough haul.
Can you know the market so well? Can Las Vegas work for an NFL team?
I think so, yeah. I do. I think it can. I think it can because I think they're going to get enough corporate money from the casinos. I think they are coming in at the right time. If Las Vegas had come into the league 7 or 8 years ago, I think this would be one of the biggest disasters we'd be talking about because they would have overbuilt the suites. They would have had, you know, 150 luxury suites, and they would have had, you know, 80,000 seats in the stadium. I think they're starting to realize that, you know, a little bit smaller stadium, like it's what some of the newer ones are doing, the University of Phoenix Stadium in Phoenix is only 74,000, that's going to be the play here. And, you know, you keep the suites down so that it's not like Jerry World where you have 300 luxury suites to sell, right? You only have, you know, 75 to 100. I think for that reason, they're going to be able to make this work.
Well, look at
if they came into the league a decade ago, disaster.
Gillette Stadium is a good example of, I think Robert Kraft built it right. He's got the right size.
Yep.
Even though he's in a huge market, right size, right amount of suites. And he used his own money. I mean, he only picked up, infrastructure money from Massachusetts, about $72 million worth, because you needed to get in and out.
Gillette Stadium is not only that. They are the blueprint. And now Gillette Stadium, you know, didn't have that blueprint first, but they did a very good job of it, where they also built it as a multi-purpose use facility. So they have an entire state, complex out there for business, for shopping, for, you know, all of that stuff.
Right.
And that's going to make a lot of sense in Las Vegas,
especially
where they're putting the stadium. So I think they're going to be able to support it. It's going to be very interesting to see that city support two professional sports teams now between the Knights and the Raiders.
The spot they're going to put in, is that that big lot adjacent to MGM?
It's right adjacent to the MGM.
Yeah, okay.
So it's all going to be very local. I mean, look, I'm excited to go to Mexico City for the Patriots and Raiders this year, so I hope the Raiders don't move too fast.
Right.
But I do think that you're going to have the ability. And, you know, what people on the East Coast may not understand is there's still a large contingent of Raiders fans that fly to Oakland for every game that are just going to switch and fly to Las Vegas for every game.
I want to ask you about the Mexico thing. You're going to go down for that. What do you want to observe, Tony, when you're down there?
I'm curious to see how it's embraced down there and for me, I'm a nerd, so it's going to be different than most. Most fans are going to say, look, it's going to be a phenomenal game between a team that's, you know, been on top and another one that looks like they're on the way up, and I get to go to Mexico City. But I really want to see the cultural difference, because what the NFL is trying to figure out is, you know, these revenue streams that they're really driving, how they're paying all these players so much money. is television and premium seating. Well, the Latin American and Central American culture is different. They buy tickets very late. There's a lot of walk-up. There's a lot of walk-up is what they call, you know, I don't buy my tickets in advance, I just walk up and buy it at the box office.
Right.
I'm really curious to see how this is going to play out at the Stadium Azteca, to see if all these things are if the gap is being bridged between how we do live events in North America and Central and South America or not. Somebody tells me it's not.
You have to do so much advance work and get a feel as to where things are going to be sometimes a year, maybe even a year and a half out.
At least.
ESPN obviously has had to try to do that. And a big story, of course, has been about rights fees. So give me now, what are the rumblings within your business, seeing what they've done, what they've hit with, but also what they've missed with?
You know, it's, to be totally honest, and not to sound like the sky is falling, I think where they missed was there's a lot of short-term understanding or a lot of short-term emphasis on revenue streams that people within the industry knew weren't going to be there anymore.
Right.
They knew that the day was going to come when somebody could opt out of the large rights fees for ESPN. Because what people don't realize is, you know, a lot of times when you're carrying like a Bravo or a channel like that, it's costing you about $1 a month, right?
Right.
But ESPN is $10 a month plus. And a lot of people are opting out of that as they're cutting cords. They had been people who were buying ESPN even though they didn't want it, right? It was bundled into their package. I think that's happening in the sports world too. I think, you know, the millennial generation has been outpriced for much of their life. And as, you know, X and the boomers are moving on, we're starting to see that in ticketing. And, you know, you and I have had this discussion before too, where, you know, perennial traditional powerhouses are starting to not sell out, you know, even college football games.
That's right.
And I think that, you know, the leagues have missed on this. The NBA is doing the best so far with it, but I would not be surprised if we're talking a decade from now of shorter schedules, smaller venues, you know, and actually seeing the salaries for these players and the luxury tax limits going down.
If I recall, the Premier League's, what, 38 matches, correct?
I think 37 or 38.
And they keep that constant. Now I bring up 38 because we know the NBA is 82, the NHL is 82, and of course Major League Baseball is 162.
Mm-hmm.
Are there elements of what Premier League does in conjunction with what MLS does that the quote major sports in this country need to think about?
I think it's an issue of watering down the product, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can talk about watering down the product in the sense of, you know, hey, I don't like the idea of an 8 seed making the Stanley Cup playoffs again, right? Because it keeps happening.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of traditional fans will say, well, that's, you know, maybe the regular season isn't worth anything. But what it really comes down to is ticketing and gate revenue, right? And when you're looking at what kind of gate the teams are driving across the, you know, games that they're running out there, and you can see that if you eliminated a good chunk of the schedule in April and May in a lot of the cities from Major League Baseball, it wouldn't be that big a change. If you eliminated, you know, anywhere from 8 to 10 games in the NBA, there wouldn't be that big a change for many of the cities. I think that's the way it's going to go. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of people try to experiment with that. So the Oakland A's, for example, sold 2,000 monthly passes this last month to see how that works.
Wow.
You can buy a pass for the A's and just go whenever you want for a month. And apparently it was very successful.
Interesting. Because in 21 and in 22, you'll have the NFL contract up, the Major League Baseball contract up, and then 22, the Big Ten becomes, after being the last to negotiate, they'll be the first to negotiate.
First to negotiate. Mm-hmm.
Are those the 2 years that we need to look at that will be a tip-off as to the next 10 years?
I think we're going to see a tip-off of the next 10 years next year in Pyeongchang.
Okay.
I think we're already seeing it. I think the Olympic movement is going to be something that's going to forerun what we're going to see with a lot of other sports. And I'd be very interested to see. I think the Olympics knows this now. They don't have a lot of bid cities, and the ones they do have are surefire things. So they don't want to piss off L.A. or Paris. They're doing the best they can to try to talk them into one of them into taking 2028. Because I think we're going to see a pretty poor showing in Pyeongchang. Tokyo, again, is another safe choice for them. But, you know, the Olympics is already struggling with viewership, and they're the ones who are kind of a forerunner for what we're able to charge as far as advertising and rights fees. I think that, you know, that number is going to go down again from what we saw in Rio. And yeah, we get to 2021 and 2022, you're going to start seeing a downtrend. You're going to start seeing a much weaker ESPN and other sports networks, and that's where the numbers start to go down. And fans say, I don't care, right? That doesn't affect me. Well, it does. It affects your team's ability to sign free agents. It affects how much money goes into the luxury tax, and it affects the salary cap across many of those sports.
What do you think? What's the future of regional networks? Because let's face it, you're in Los Angeles. The Dodgers really mm-hmm. rely on that, even though they're not getting cleared by everybody by a wide margin.
100%.
I mean, even with Vin Scully, they couldn't get cleared. But the Dodgers are reaping the economic benefit of it. What are regional networks, and what did they mean to clubs, and can they continue to exist at the level they are? Because they need the programming.
It's really difficult to do, right? So, you know, I've got very close friends at some of the major networks that negotiate these deals. And, you know, a lot of times the teams look at these regional networks and say, I want to put together this deal that's going to be really, very valuable to me. Well, go and do an internet search on the Houston Astros and the Houston Rockets situation. They tried to create a joint venture regional network, and it completely exploded. It ended up in court, and, you know, I don't know who ended up going in and swiping it. I think it might have been Fox Sports.
I think it was
Fox
Sports.
But getting it for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, Fox Sports did. Yeah. They got it for almost nothing.
Got it for, pennies on the dollar. And I know the guy who does those deals for them. And, you know, the reality is there's such a big upside to these regional networks, and even to the, you know, conference networks. The Pac-12 network's been a great success. So is the Big Ten network. However, how are they going to negotiate it going forward, knowing that how we're consuming media is changing and we're going to see downward trend in a lot of these different, you know, sports and leagues? So, and look, these downward trends, things aren't going away forever. Soccer's on the uprise, right? The MLS is doing great.
Yep. No, they are. They are doing great. I always have to ask you what's hot, what's not. So, year and a half, 2 years out, because you're already thinking that far ahead. I mean, things I'm talking about you that we're talking in current time, you were already predicting on this show 2 years ago. So 2 years out, what's hot, what's not, based on the return and what your partners are telling you right now?
Well, Pyeongchang is a problem. That's something that we're seeing almost no interest in, and people are already starting to get concerned about it. You know, I think what's interesting is what we're going to see over the next couple of years is a couple of different cities that were selected in the arrogant era of sports,
right?
In the mid-2000s, in the early, 2010s, where rights fees were coming out our ears, you know, corruption was rampant. Hey, you know what? Let's put the World Cup in Qatar. Let's put the World Cup in Russia, where it's going to be in 2018. I don't think people realize we're going to Russia in 2018, and then in 2022, we're going to Qatar. I was in Dubai less than a month ago. That is not a place you want to go for the World Cup, right? Those are just so, so soft. But because those are soft, I think you're going to see strength when it comes to the more traditional Super Bowl cities, right?
Right.
Next year, we're not going to be all that traditional. But, you know, from there forward, that's where the money goes, right? So I think, you know, we've got this era over the next 2-3 years of just really obscure places to hold major events, right? Nobody wants to go to Minnesota for the Super Bowl. Not in February.
Right.
It's not a destination. Nobody wants to go to Russia in 2018 for the World Cup, especially under the geopolitical setup we're under now.
Right.
Nobody wants to go to Pyeongchang. Are you kidding me? Right now, they're shooting missiles all over the place, and we're all going to fly to Pyeongchang for the Olympics.
Right. And then Qatar in 22.
And then Qatar in 2022. I mean, we've got this next 5 years of ridiculousness, which is basically all of us paying for the arrogance and opulence of the late 2000s.
I lied about the last question. I actually have to follow up because it's so fascinating. Are you seeing in local governments, right, because they're the ones that have to make the bids, a realization that you're talking about? Because Boston backed out on the U.S. bid.
Yeah, they got out.
I mean, they got out.
And they didn't necessarily want to get out.
I mean, oh, no.
People forced them out.
Oh, no. People forced them out. I mean, believe me, I've driven on 128 just on a normal day, let alone let's close off the city. What are you, nuts? But are they starting to understand, based on their economic reality, that this is not the boom that it's perceived to be from years gone by? That, hey, we're going to get the Olympics and whatever, and we're going to all benefit?
No. Absolutely not. And that, and the Olympics is in a terrible position right now that they'll never admit. They currently have two legitimate bid cities for the next two games that are available. Each one of them is flexing a little bit of muscle, saying we don't want 2020, we don't want 2028, we want 2024.
Okay.
And they're going to need to find and manipulate their way around this, because, you know, they're also looking at geopolitical setups, but they know that Los Angeles is, you know, plug and play, right? If they can repeat what they did in 84, because this is not much different than the setup was in 1984,
right?
When the Olympics was already on hard times, we were coming off of tragedy in prior games and, you know, questionable safety. They went to Los Angeles and made money, right? And kind of got their mojo back.
Right.
So, and we'll see.
but they use the Coliseum, and the Coliseum doesn't have the track anymore. They'd actually have to build facilities.
Yeah, they'd have to build the track of the Coliseum. They have to build a facility in the valley. But the facilities aren't, it's not like it is at many of the other locations, right? I think the days of picking Rio and picking Sochi and building ghost towns are over, and Beijing are over, right? Those are just, I think the local governments are starting to realize that this is just a giant disaster. It's not helping us, and it's in fact making us a laughing stock. I mean, the Rio Olympic venues are not even public parks anymore. The Beijing Olympic venues are unused. It's, I think they got to go with LA and Paris, and then we'll see what happens next. Okay. The unfortunate thing is, you know, unless FIFA can find a way to move the World Cup, which is not something that hasn't happened before, right? Right. They have done this before.
Right.
2022 is going to be an unmitigated disaster.
You're right. You know I could do like 10 more hours of this with you, right?
I love this part. This is my favorite part of the month.
I have such a good time talking with you. Tony, it is always a pleasure. I hope the baby's doing well.
Oh, fantastic.
Walking
and starting to talk. Yeah, she's starting to talk. We need to stop.
Oh.
This growing up is happening way too fast.
Oh, well, you know, let's see. Age-wise, they could take over the play-by-play job here. Age-wise.
Maybe I want him to do that. I've been watching a lot of 7-year-old baseball and softball, and I'm ready to move to the booth.
I hear you. Tony, always a pleasure. My best to you. Can't wait to talk to you again next month.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Tony Knopp. Man, well, I like talking to that guy. Wow. We will come back, wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
The phones are ringing off the hook at Sunbury Motors Hyundai because right now we're offering the best savings in Hyundai's 30-year history, like up to $6,750 in total savings on the 2017 Sonata. It's called the Better Than Ever Sales Event, and it features the biggest total savings ever offered on Sonata, Elantra, Tucson, and Santa Fe Sport. So there's never been a better time to buy than the Better Than Ever Sales Event. Every Hyundai is also backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain limited warranty. America's best warranty. So visit Sunbury Motors Hyundai, Hyundai now before the biggest savings in Hyundai's Hyundai history are, well, history. Better is the reason to buy a Hyundai, Hyundai, and the Better Than Ever sales event is the reason to buy now. Sunbury Motors Hyundai is Hyundai, your home for, well, better. Better prices, better vehicles, and a better buying experience. Sunbury Motors Hyundai, Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza in Sunbury and online at sunburyhyundai.com.
Hyundai.
It is an interesting time in sports. You're seeing people, they love it, they enjoy it, but at the same time, with the cord cutting that we're seeing, there's so many expenses that millennials have that we didn't have, Sean. I mean, and the big one is college debt. Say, for example, you're 30 years old and you'd like to buy a house, for example. Well, that means that if you were to do it, you'd have a mortgage. But you probably already have a car payment. But now you also have to add in the fact that you also have that student loan payment.
Depending on what you're majoring in, you could still be paying another 20, 30, 40 grand worth of debt.
Right. So now where does your disposable income go? Where do you cut back if you want to do something like that? And that's what you have to take a long, hard look at. And so there are people that have cut the cord, and they're out there using Apple TV, whatever, to pick up singular entities along the way through apps. It's a great time to be in digital media.
Suit's going to laugh at us someday.
You'd have to get it first.
Your station for news, weather, business, and CBS Sports Radio. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury and on WKOK.com.